Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. This is Here and Now. Less than 2 weeks after Congress passed his $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package, President Biden is readying an even larger package on infrastructure. It's part of his effort to make good on his Build Back Better campaign promise. Let's talk more about it now with NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hey, Mara.
Hi, Callum.
So can you tell us a little bit more about this package and what the money would go to?
Well, if you think of the rescue plan, the COVID relief bill, as putting out the fire, this Build Back Better agenda is meant to reconstruct the house. So it is a lot of investments in what you might call human infrastructure, universal pre-K, free community college, lots of investments in physical infrastructure that goes way beyond roads and bridges, major investments in manufacturing and technology of the future like 5G, a green electric grid, universal broadband, carbon-free transportation, and it includes some pay-fors, things that Biden talked about during the campaign, raising the corporate income tax and raising the individual income tax for people making $400,000 and up.
Well, Mara, as you say that this goes well beyond the sort of classic infrastructure items like roads and bridges, I'm reminded of the criticism the president got from Republicans when he was trying to pass his COVID relief package. Of course, GOP lawmakers said there's a lot of items in here that aren't strictly related to the pandemic. I wonder if you can foresee similar objections to this infrastructure bill.
Well, I guess what the Democrats consider infrastructure, or the Republicans might consider a social program for, you know, people who are unworthy, I guess. But also, don't forget, this will depend a lot on how Biden sells this bill and frames it. He is going to say that the United States has not invested in itself for a long time. We're losing our technological and economic superiority to China. And outcompeting China is something that both parties agree on. It's going to be at the heart of his sales pitch for Build Back Better. So I think it really depends how he sells it. And also, if this bill is pushed as one gigantic thing, like the COVID relief bill, that Republicans can object to pieces of it, or will he break off the popular parts? You know, universal broadband is paid for by the last spectrum, FCC spectrum auction, and it's very popular. So are some other parts of infrastructure.
So that's how one piece of the checklist gets paid for. But we're talking about $3 trillion here, Mara. So how is
right,
the administration planning to pay for the rest of it?
The tax hikes could pay for some of it. Adding to the deficit, which both parties have been very willing to do in the recent past, could be part of it. But there's no doubt that Republicans are going to say it's too big, it's too expensive, it's filled with tax hikes. As Mitch McConnell said, it's a Trojan horse for tax hikes and the Green New Deal. There's going to be a lot of green climate investments in this bill. So there are a lot of roadblocks. The first one, of course, is trying to get 50 Democratic votes. If Joe Manchin doesn't like your bill, it's not going to pass. So that's the first roadblock. And then, of course, figuring out if some parts of this can be broken off and get 60 votes, you know, get support from Republicans separately from what you probably are going to have to put into another giant reconciliation package. That's the kind of budget bill that doesn't need 60 votes. It only needs 51.
Sure. Joe Manchin, of course, is the Democratic senator from the red state of West Virginia, who's often a swing vote on these matters.
Right.
And there's that question of whether Democrats will try to go it alone, or do you see, you mentioned the possibility of maybe a skinny bill, Mara, that might be able to get some GOP support. Does one scenario seem more likely than the other at this point?
I think both scenarios are likely. I think they're going to break off pieces of this into smaller individual bills and see if they can pass with Republican support. I think there are some things, especially anything about competing with China, that has bipartisan support. For instance, Chuck Schumer has a China bill with Todd Young, a Republican senator. So some things they could get through with Republican support, but I do think in the end the Democrats are going to have to use reconciliation again. That's the budget maneuver that allows them to pass things with 51 votes. It was basically a carve-out from the filibuster in the 1970s. That's how we got reconciliation. But yes, I think they're going to do both things. Some things they're going to have to pass on reconciliation with Democratic votes only. Other things they might be able to break off into bite-sized legislative chunks and pass with Republican support.
In just the moment we have, Mara, the backdrop here, of course, is that before we know it, we'll be to midterm election time. And, of course, what happens here will impact the way that the president and his party is viewed by voters. What are the stakes here?
The stakes are very, very high. Joe Biden is determined to deliver on his promises. He promised a gigantic infrastructure plan. That's what voters care about. Voters also care about how he goes about doing this. He promised during the campaign that he'd work across the aisle. So the big question for the White House is how politically necessary do they feel bipartisan buy-in is on this package? They couldn't get any for the COVID relief bill, but how hard and how long is Biden willing to try to get Republican support?
That's NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson, with the latest. Mara, thank you.
You're welcome.
At this very moment in schools throughout the country, educators are maneuvering the complicated task of teaching during a pandemic. The new CDC guidelines recommends all students wear masks and sit 3 feet apart. A 6 feet distance rule is still required during lunch or at sporting events. And scientists hope this new guidance will help more schools reopen. Maria Vasquez is deputy superintendent for Orange County Public Schools, serving the area around Orlando, Florida, and joins us now with more on how that district is handling social distancing in the classroom. Welcome back to Here and Now.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you for being here. The last time you spoke with us, you mentioned that 60% of students in the district were actually already attending in-person classes 5 days a week. That's a pretty big number. How's it going now?
We have gone from 30% of our students attending face-to-face instruction in the fall to 60% at this time. Many of the schools in Florida have had to adjust the spacing of desks due to the increased enrollment. So we have been operating in many of our schools under the new guidelines of 3 feet between the desks.
You bring up a very important point in all of this, because some schools in other parts of the country were already going to 3 feet before these updated guidance measures, because they just don't have the space to properly distance in classrooms. How are teachers and families responding to these new relaxed guidelines? Are more parents wanting to send their kids back to in-person school?
I can tell you from our experience that our parents did not react negatively. I think that is in large part to all of the other safety measures we have in place. First and foremost, the mandatory wearing of masks. That coupled with the enhanced cleaning protocols that we have in place and monitoring that students are practicing social distancing at all times has really helped us keep our schools open and our students safe. Our positivity rate continues to be well below our community rate. I think we're currently at about 4%, and it may be a little bit lower than that prior to spring break.
Have there been any surprises in implementing these guidelines for your district? I'm just thinking, you know, theoretically for us who aren't in the classroom, we can only imagine what it's like to have 25, 30 students, especially at an elementary school level, with masks on their faces, trying to distance them. What are some surprises that you might have learned that can help other districts as they move through and try to figure out how to bring kids safely back to school?
I think our greatest surprise was how well our students adapted to the environment and the wearing of masks. At the beginning, when we first opened schools, we did spend a lot of time talking about the new protocols, making sure they understood the proper way to wear masks. And that has continued to be reinforced throughout the entire school year, as well as, you know, the hand washing and additional hygiene requirements that we have. So I think that really has been our greatest surprise, is that our children have been incredibly resilient and adaptive.
Yeah, kids definitely are resilient. You know, we've been talking a lot about learning loss this pandemic school year, and your district is also extending summer school to help students catch up. Do you think that this will be enough?
We have expanded our summer school to go for June and July. But we know that many of our children are going to need extended learning opportunities for the upcoming school year and for next summer. We are incredibly grateful for the federal dollars that are coming our way that's going to allow us to not only keep our schools open and safe, but allow us to provide resources and supports so that our children begin to regain that lost learning.
That's Maria Vasquez, Deputy Superintendent for Orange County Public Schools in Florida. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Israelis are headed to the polls again. This is the country's fourth election in just 2 years and will be a referendum on the divisive rule of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Opinion polls forecast a tight race between Netanyahu and his opponents, who have the support of vocal Israelis who no longer want him in office. Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace and a former Middle East analyst for the State Department, and he joins us now. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure, Tanya.
Yes, so Aaron, help us understand why there have been so many elections in Israel over the past 2 years.
You know, unlike the United States, where you have a direct election, you don't have a parliamentary or cabinet system, where, in fact, Israelis are voting for party lists, and at the top of each list is the party's first choice, presumably, to become prime minister. So in order to govern in an Israeli parliament, 120 seats, you need 60 plus one. And that therein lies the, I think, the all the contradictions and the anomalies of Israeli politics. You need 60 plus one in order to govern effectively. So you need to put together a coalition. In this case, there's another factor as well. You have a prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who is now under indictment for fraud, breach of trust, and bribery. And during the course of the last three elections, has done everything he possibly can to try to assemble a narrow government in an effort to overturn or at least pass legislation that would prevent a prime minister from being indicted while in office. So the combination of proportional representation, divisions within the country, and Netanyahu's legal travails have brought us to an extraordinary point, five elections in a little over 2 years.
With all of this in mind, I mean, what is Netanyahu's case for staying in power?
You know, it's funny because, in a way, he's now the longest governing prime minister in the history of the state of Israel, surpassing Israel's greatest prime minister, David Ben-Gurion. In many respects, in terms of management of COVID, and that has been a checkered enterprise. Three or four lockdowns, politicizing the virus. But at the same time, Netanyahu has been obsessive in terms of acquiring vaccines. Now you have 56% of a country of 9 million people having received at least one shot. And by comparison, Israelis will go to the polls energized at his back to life, quote unquote, back to life campaign, the campaign of Likud, his party, watching Europe struggle still with surges and outbreaks. He's also been risk averse when it comes to involving Israelis in unwise adventurous military enterprises. And finally, he has, despite his right-wing policy, settlement activity, and the like, succeeded in creating a diplomatic outreach, which has the state of Israel now recognized or in some form of diplomatic contact with more countries in the world, in Asia, Latin America, and Europe, than any time since independence. So he's been quite competent and effective, and there has not been a candidate that essentially
that
has
shown
his stature
that,
or his successes.
Right. Well, the 30 seconds or so I have with you, while in office, former President Trump had a close relationship with Netanyahu, but President Biden waited nearly a month before he made a call to him, which some actually saw that as a snub. What's at stake for the relationship between the U.S. and Israel in today's election?
I mean, I think a lot. Joe Biden is not Donald Trump. The sugar high that the Trump administration created for Mr. Netanyahu over the course of the last 4 years is over. Whether it was a snub or an effort simply to demonstrate, send a signal to the prime minister that I'm not going to be involved in your reelection campaign. And frankly, given the challenges I face in domestic recovery, Israel, frankly, and your problems are not at the top of my list. I think those are the signals that Joe Biden wanted to send Netanyahu. So there'll be no gifts before this election.
Yes, and I'm going to have to cut you off. We'll have to talk about this much more as that election goes on. Aaron David Miller is Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former State Department Middle East analyst. Thank you so much.
Take care, Daniel.
Well, the pandemic will eventually end, but the coronavirus may be with us for years to come. To be more specific, most epidemiologists think the virus will continue to circulate in pockets of the global population, even if vaccines severely limit its spread and blunt its worst effects. Scientifically speaking, that would mean the virus will become endemic. But what does that mean for everyday life? Well, Jenny Levine is a postdoctoral fellow at Emory University, and she's here to help us understand. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
We're glad to have you. And you were the lead author of a recent paper in the journal Science that modeled how the coronavirus could become endemic. So how would that happen?
Well, the first thing to note is that for something to become endemic, it just means that it circulates all the time. So lots of things are endemic, like influenza, for example. But the key thing that we show in that paper is not only is the coronavirus likely to become endemic, it is likely to become mild in its endemic state, which is a very optimistic scenario for us people on this planet Earth.
Yeah, mild sounds better, but the fact that it could continue to circulate may be disappointing for people who've been thinking, well, won't we just have so much immunity from either people who've already had COVID-19 or people who've gotten vaccinated? Wouldn't the virus eventually have no way to spread?
That can happen for certain pathogens that interact with our immune system in a way that generates very, very strong immunity. So to get that kind of herd immunity that lasts a long time, you really need to have immunity that lasts at least decades, maybe lifelong, so that really the only new people coming into the population that are susceptible are babies. And then you can vaccinate them and really mitigate the spread of the disease. And that's, for example, what we do with measles. You have very, very long-lasting immunity to it. So as long as we just keep vaccinating kids as they're born, the population doesn't support the spread of the virus. Unfortunately, SARS-CoV-2 does not seem to have that kind of long-lasting transmission-blocking immunity, which means that it's much more likely to remain endemic. As people's immunity wanes, people can get reinfected and then spread the virus. But so long as the immunity that we have against severe disease is long-lasting, which seems relatively likely, it will keep circulating, but people will not be getting very sick from it anymore because they will have had some amount of immunity from either a prior infection or a vaccination.
One other thing that we've all been watching with some alarm, of course, is new variants of this coronavirus emerging in different parts of the world. And that's one of the concerns, right, that perhaps variants develop after the coronavirus becomes endemic. So is there a risk that we could find our antibodies and vaccines are no longer effective against this coronavirus over time and that we'll have to get new vaccinations every year?
It is possible. Certainly the variants are something that we need to be watching carefully, and in particular watching how severe are reinfections. So just as over time immunity can wane and you might no longer have transmission blocking immunity, so you can get infected but you don't get very sick, it seems likely that with many of the variants, you can get infected with a new variant sooner than you could with the variant that you were initially infected with, so reinfected with a different strain more quickly. But our hope is, and it seems very likely, that you still won't get very, very sick from that infection with a new variant because you'll have partial immunity from your previous infection with a different variant. And there's a bunch of immunological research that's going on right now that's really showing that different components of our immunity, antibody-based immunity versus T-cell-based immunity, for example, they wane at different rates. So the antibodies wane faster, the T-cells wane a bit slower, and The antibodies are more specific to a strain, so they're less protective against a new variant, whereas the T cells are more protective against a new variant. So we're hoping, and it seems reasonable given the scientific evidence that we are gathering at this point and the studies that immunologists are doing, that the variants will still be fairly mild in people who were previously infected or vaccinated, even with a different strain. But this is a key and really crucial thing to be measuring now, because it is absolutely true that if that doesn't hold, then we really need to be focusing very quickly on rapidly developing updated vaccines for those new strains.
So is there anything that we should be doing to prepare for the endemic outcome that your model predicts? And I'm thinking, for example, of some of the COVID-19 long haulers, some of whom say they actually didn't have a very severe case at the outset, but they feel lingering effects over time. Is that something that we can prepare for, perhaps, in a future where the coronavirus is endemic?
That's a great question. I think the other really key thing to be following is, so for the people who are experiencing that right now, first of all, we just need to be figuring out what we can do to mitigate that for them. And hopefully people who get, let's say, a vaccine and then maybe a few years in the future get a reinfection, we hope that they will not have those long-haul symptoms, but we of course don't know. So that's something to be watching for. Similarly, like whether those long-haul symptoms are happening much in young children is really crucial to keep finding out. So in a sense, the long-haul symptoms make the disease more severe. It's not severe in that immediate short acute phase, but it's more severe in the long run. And if there is that kind of severity in young children, then our strategy is definitely going to have to change to really mitigate transmission, even among young children.
Jenny Levine is a postdoctoral fellow at Emory University and lead author of a recent paper in the journal Science about how the coronavirus could go from pandemic to endemic. Jenny, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we don't just catch you up on the news. We help you make sense of what's happening, whether it's how to tackle the challenges that come with pregnancy during a pandemic or how to understand the crisis unfolding along our southern border. We'll fill you in for 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
President Biden has been celebrating the quickening pace of vaccinations in the United States, and it likely won't be long before there are more than enough doses for every adult in America. Now the Biden administration has taken its first steps to share extra vaccines with other countries. Advocates say vaccine diplomacy could benefit both global health and America's standing in the world. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith reports on this story that first aired on All Things Considered.
Early on, the Biden administration said it would contribute $4 billion to COVAX, the global effort to vaccinate people in poor countries. But when it comes to vaccine doses themselves, the White House has had an America First approach. Here was President Biden earlier this month.
We're going to start off making sure Americans are taken care of first, but we're then going to try to help the rest of the world.
Last week, when the White House announced plans to loan millions of doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine to Canada and Mexico, COVID response coordinator Jeff Zients was careful to emphasize,
"No American will be without a vaccine because of this action."
The fact that the AstraZeneca vaccine isn't yet authorized for use in the U.S., but is in Canada and Mexico, smoothed over any potential domestic political backlash. And even as Biden said, Americans need to come first, he has begun arguing the U.S. has an interest in vaccines getting to its neighbors and the rest of the world.
This is not something that can be stopped by a fence, no matter how high you build a fence or a wall. So we're not going to be ultimately safe until the world is safe.
Before getting further into global vaccine sharing, Press Secretary Jen Psaki says the administration is focused on figuring out which vaccines work best against virus variants and which ones work best on children. But Carolyn Reynolds, co-founder of the Pandemic Action Network, says the U.S. has contracts for hundreds of millions more doses than it will need to vaccinate all Americans. And time is of the essence because virus variants could undermine the vaccines.
The faster that they're allowed to evolve, the longer it's going to take us to get out of this crisis. So it is in our national interest to be able to get the vaccine out there more widely around the world as soon as possible.
Reynolds says the U.S. needs to do more than contribute money to the global effort. She says the best way to help is to contribute doses to COVAX rather than do a bunch of bilateral deals like the ones with Mexico and Canada.
We're not going to end this pandemic solving it country by country, region by region. It's really got to be a global response.
There's an active debate about the best way for the U.S. to show global leadership on vaccines. Russia and China have made a show of distributing their vaccines to countries in need, in part to exert global influence. Amanda Glassman at the Center for Global Development thinks some bilateral vaccine deals would be good for the U.S. She recently spoke to a colleague in Senegal whose mother got a Chinese vaccine.
Now, it's not a competition, but I would love to see our country, the United States, be in that same place and having those same kinds of conversations and being the source of something so important that someone can say their grandmother was vaccinated yesterday. That matters to people.
Psaki said that U.S. vaccine sharing likely will include a mix of bilateral agreements and contributions to COVAX. Global health advocates just want the U.S. to hurry up and announce its plans. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Putting a price on carbon emissions was the subject of Monday's White House meeting with 10 of the oil industry's biggest companies. In a development that may surprise some, the fossil fuel executive said they support making greenhouse gas emissions more costly. Robin Farzad is here to help explain what's going on. He's the host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Callum, how are you?
I'm well. So, Robin, attendees at this meeting included oil giants like ExxonMobil, Chevron, Royal Dutch Shell. Now, they weren't happy when President Biden suspended new oil and gas leasing on federal land right after taking office. And yet they're on board with this idea of putting a price on carbon emissions. Why?
Yeah, I mean, can you just count on good citizenship and a flawed free market to drastically reduce carbon, which has kind of become the prevailing goal for most developed countries at the very least? So this is a realization that some goal or target or benchmark has to underpin what you're seeing are billions and billions of dollars of investments in renewables and carbon capture technology. Callum, I saw one Spanish energy executive put it this way. The question comes whether this is contingent or is dependent on having a carbon price. The simple answer is yes, absolutely.
I see, because there may be this agreement in principle, but the details matter, of course. And American oil companies may object if new costs make them less competitive with foreign producers, for example. So what do we know about how exactly a price on greenhouse gas emissions would be levied?
Not too much at this point. And it's going to be a grueling negotiation and back and forth with so many different players. There is that fear that nations and companies outside the carbon trading program would dump cheap fuel into the global market, making it difficult for the participants to compete. Oil and natural gas, of course, they're fungible. You can blockade or sanction a nation as much as you want, but its contraband is going to find its way into the marketplace.
There is a broader context here too, Robin. I mean, we're seeing more big oil companies pledging to become carbon neutral over time. Last year, for example, BP chief Bernard Looney said the company intends to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050. So should we expect more oil companies to follow suit, and what's motivating them?
Oh, this new White House, for one, and the Paris Agreement is no longer backburnered. You're seeing pressure from institutions, pension funds, universities, shareholder activists. Witness the grief ExxonMobil got recently for not being aggressive enough in renewables investment, an argument that was especially compelling a year ago when global energy prices, they just tanked. And Exxon was subsequently booted from the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Its overseas rivals are targeting net zero emissions. Tesla, meanwhile, is the most valuable car maker on the planet, and it doesn't use a drop of gasoline, and states are taking action against fossil fuel-operated power plants, so it's coming from all directions.
A lot of context there, and of course, we do have to watch and see whether these oil companies actually hit targets that are decades away, by the way. I will add, too, Robin, that in sort of a twist, some environmentalists in recent years have actually begun to question how effective measures like carbon taxes actually are. So why the skepticism?
Measuring and monitoring are going to be so difficult, for starters. We see now that leaks are more rampant than we had imagined. Methane, in particular, this White House notes, is particularly destructive and has to be capped. If you don't effectively price carbon emissions, can major oil firms and construction firms in China, for example, just pay their way through much of the status quo? I saw a study that found that annual average emissions fell about 2% in countries without a carbon price and rose about 3% in those without one. So this analysis, suggests that 2 percentage points of the 5-point difference are due to carbon price in particular. So it is going to be a grueling negotiation, tons of details, tons of players, but you're finally starting to see unanimity.
All right. That's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, thanks.
Thank you.
The suspect arrested in Atlanta for killing 8 people, 6 of whom were Asian women, has been charged with 8 counts of murder. But authorities have stopped shy of classifying the killings as a hate crime, and that's drawn nationwide condemnation, with many believing the crime fits into a pattern of rising attacks against Asian Americans. Janine Bell is a law professor at Indiana University who has studied hate crimes for more than 20 years, and she joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. Since the 1980s, 47 states and the federal government have passed hate crime laws. In the legal sense, how is a hate crime defined?
Hate crimes are crimes motivated by bias on the basis of race, religion, sexual orientation, gender identity. The actual categories vary by statute.
Okay, so it varies really depending on where you are and what those statutes say. But even with these laws on the books, many hate crimes fall through the cracks because they're kind of difficult to prove in a court of law. Why is that?
Prosecutors say that juries are reluctant to convict individuals for hate crimes, particularly if the only evidence is that they use slurs, because individuals use slurs all the time. An easy one is a case where individuals intentionally selected the victim because of their background. That's what you're trying to prove in all hate crime cases.
How often is a hate crime designation used in this country?
FBI data suggests that law enforcement agencies are really not noting hate crime at all. 86% of law enforcement agencies reported that no hate crimes had occurred in their jurisdiction in 2019, which is the latest year that figures are available. That absolutely does not sound right.
Okay, so in the case of Atlanta, the suspect told authorities he had a sex addiction, which investigators say, at least at this stage, suggests that this rampage was not racially motivated. But as we've learned, there is a long racist history of sexualizing and objectifying Asian women. So under what you're saying, the implementation of these laws have significant gaps.
Well, what constitutes a hate crime is intentional selection. So the investigator spoke perhaps prematurely in that particular case because we don't know why the perpetrator selected his victim. The history, as you note, suggests that race was part of it, gender was part of it, but you need full investigation of the case to say why the defendant actually selected and targeted his victims.
You did a study in the late 1990s that found police departments with units that specialize in hate crimes were better at identifying them. But a lot of police departments don't have dedicated hate crime units. So without that training, are officers more hesitant to investigate something as a hate crime?
I think absolutely. Officers who don't have or not part of a hate crime unit may be investigating their very first hate crime. And think about this particular circumstance. We had an officer in a state that had just recently, this summer, passed hate crime legislation. So this is not an individual who's experienced in identifying bias motivation. So it leaves law enforcement officials really at sea, because hate crime is unlike other crime, because you have to figure out why the person did the crime.
You know, hate crimes often go unreported because it's up to the victim to prove the crime committed against them was racist, for instance. I mean, is it time to re-examine this now that we are having more nuanced conversations about what racism and other forms of hate can look like?
Yes, there's nothing wrong with the law. We have to re-examine the ways in which law enforcement treats this law, because there are law enforcement agencies that can and do a good job at this. In the study that I did in the late 1990s, I studied a police hate crime unit that they well served victims of hate crime, and they also protected the First Amendment. Critics of hate crime legislation don't like it because they believe that individuals are going to be arrested for hate crime just for using slurs. And I found that the detectives in the unit, because they'd been properly schooled on the First Amendment, were able to protect the First Amendment and also adequately serve victims of hate crime.
That's Indiana University law professor Janine Bell. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
For the first time in six decades, new fragments of the Dead Sea Scrolls have been unearthed in desert caves in the West Bank near Qumran. To find them, a team of archaeologists rappelled down a cliff, which brought them to a vast cavern known as the Cave of Horror. That's where they began to dig. The original scrolls, discovered in the 1940s and 50s, include the earliest known copies of biblical texts, outlining the beliefs of an ancient Jewish sect. They're arguably one of the most significant finds of the 20th century. Dead Sea Scrolls scholar Oren Abelman is with the Israel Antiquities Authority, which launched the search for the newest artifacts. He joins us from Jerusalem. Welcome.
Good to be here.
So there's so much to discuss here, and I want to start with probably the biggest question people have, which is, what is on the roughly two dozen bits of parchment that your team found in that desert cave? I mean, these are tiny scraps, right?
These are tiny scraps, but some of them we did manage to kind of put a puzzle together. And what we found was one fragment of the book of Nahum, chapter 1, verse 5, and a bit of the beginning of verse 6, and more impressively, a collection of fragments that turned out to be Zechariah, chapter 8, verses 16 to 17.
And that passage, I believe, reads, "These are the things you are to do, speak the truth to one another, render true and perfect justice in your gates." It sounds like you're uncovering some timeless advice here.
That is true, and when putting kind of the pieces together, that is what it felt like. I didn't mention beforehand that the language these fragments are in is Greek, which is not the typical language we find of biblical books in the Judean desert. However, there are several manuscripts that were also found that were in Greek, and we have a lot of new pieces to the kind of the puzzle of this manuscript.
I understand that the name of God appears in Hebrew, but the rest of it, as you say, is it in a Greek translation. What does that tell you about the context here? Who did the translating, and what the significance is of these pieces of the scrolls that you found?
The most famous translation of the Hebrew Bible into Greek is what's known as the Septuagint, which was done in Egypt starting in the 3rd century BCE. This specific version of the Greek that we have is not the Septuagint, but is kind of a reworking. The fact that in this scroll the name of God is actually still in Hebrew, in the ancient Hebrew script, it wasn't even the script commonly used at that time, implies a way of showing how important the name of God is. It might also have something to do with mystical meanings given to the name of God.
When it comes to other finds, I know that in addition to these scroll fragments, you've also found a very special basket, which may in fact be the oldest known basket in the world. Tell us about that.
This basket, it looks completely new, but it turned out to be 10,500 years old, which makes it, to the best of our knowledge, the oldest complete basket ever discovered anywhere in the world. And it's also an important find to understanding early stages of human civilization, since this predates the invention of ceramics.
You know, the discoveries themselves are impressive, but I have to say the way that they were discovered is equally impressive. This vision of archaeologists rappelling down a cliff into a place called the Cave of Horrors conjures a scene from an Indiana Jones movie. First of all, why is this place known as the Cave of Horrors?
So there are two versions of why that name was given to this cave, and it's probably a combination of both of these stories. The first one is really that that way to down to that cave is really very frightening. It's a very sheer cliff, and personally, it's one of the only caves I do not want to go into. I'll leave that to the expert rappellers. The other reason is when archaeologists first found this cave in the 1950s, they found close to 40 skeletons waiting for them there. So that's another reason why it was given the name the Cave of Horrors.
And, you know, there's one other nugget to this discovery that I just have to mention, which is that we're reading that the decision to do a full excavation of the site came after a colleague took a bathroom break. Oriya Amakai has told the newspaper that she went off and crouched to pee and saw the sole of an ancient Roman sandal sticking out of the ground. And she thinks that her male colleagues might have missed it because they would have been standing up. It's really a twist of serendipity.
Yes, and but it also has to do, I think, with her, specifically with her skill in noticing items. She was also one of the main people who found the fragments while sifting them. She seems to have a better eye than most of us.
Before we go, could you just reflect on what this discovery means to you?
I work mainly on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the Dead Sea Scrolls is really taking a lot of small fragments and putting a puzzle together. Having new, completely new pieces is something that I always dreamed of but never really expected to come true. And this is something that we hope will also help us gain knowledge that will help us conserve the other scrolls and make sure that they survive much longer.
That's historian Oren Abelman. He's part of the Israel Antiquities Authority team that unearthed new Dead Sea Scrolls fragments this month. Thanks so much for telling us about your discoveries.
Thank you for talking to me. It was a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.